welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. One of the oldest friends of the program is the provocateur philosopher Peter Singer. And later on tonight, I'm going to introduce you to two of his acolytes, Toby Ord and Bernadette Young. Peter's moral philosophizing have inspired Toby and Bernadette to give away a huge amount of their money. And given that they're impecunious, this is all the more astonishing. But they don't just hand it out blindly or foolishly. They're very analytical as to where they make their philanthropic contributions. I think you'll find it fascinating. We have done so many programs on PTSD over the years. Lost count of them. But tonight we're going to do another, where we're going to see it through an entirely different prism provided by Sebastian Younger. Now, how can it be, dear listener, that only 10% of American forces see combat, yet the US military has the highest rate of post-traumatic stress disorder in its history and probably in the world? And here's another statement for you. Well, we've heard a bit about this. For most veterans with combat trauma, the problem isn't so much the battlefield, but much closer to home. It's something that Sebastian, war correspondent, writer, documentary maker, has investigated and written about in his Vanity Fair article called The Bonds of Battle. Sebastian himself has suffered from PTSD after returning from a two-month assignment covering the war in Afghanistan. We'll get to that in a moment. You will know him from his documentaries on the Afghanistan conflict, Restrepo and Karengal, and also his book simply called War. And, of course, famously, he's the author of The Perfect Storm. He's on the blower from New York City. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi there. Thank you.
Sebastian, the U.S. military has the highest rate of PTSD in its military history. Is that simply because we know what it is? We can diagnose the disorder? Perhaps it was even more intense during the Civil War.
Well, it's hard to go back to a war like the Civil War because you're absolutely right. They weren't keeping very good records, and they had a very, I think, very simple psychological understanding. But certainly from the 20th century, what we've seen is that every war, thank God, casualties have plummeted. And you go from World War I to World War II, Vietnam, and then the current wars, casualties have gone down very, very steeply, which means the intensity of combat has dropped. And presumably the level of trauma that troops are exposed to has dropped. But strangely, with every war, disability claims have gone up precipitously, and many, they don't always break it out by what kind of claim it is, but in very, very large percentages PTSD. Now something like 50% of the military are claiming disability, much of it for PTSD, and only 10% of the military these days sees combat. So there's this huge gap. Some of it obviously is malingering, it's fraud, just people trying to claim disability benefits. And some of it is something else. And I think what I try to understand in the article is how is it that a soldier could not see combat, not be traumatized, and then come home and honestly feel out of place, like they don't belong, like they'd rather be back in the war? Like what is going on there?
Well, we're going to investigate that in our conversation, but let's just have a reality check. You talk about the Israel's defense forces, where the rate is as low as 1%, despite the fact that they're on constant alert for long periods of time.
That's right. I'm studying anthropology in college, and having been with the U.S. military quite a bit, I had this idea, and seeing these PTSD claims, I had this idea that maybe the levels of PTSD in a military are a function not of the level of trauma on the battlefield, but a function of something else, something in society back home, not appreciation. American soldiers are enormously appreciated back home, but something else, something about the cohesiveness of society. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation in the western United States, and I had this idea, the Navajo, the Apache, the Comanche, when they're fighting in the 1800s when they're fighting each other in the U.S. cavalry, they probably weren't coming back to camp with PTSD. It was something I couldn't prove, but it was an idea that I had, and that was how I started looking into Israel.
Well, the results are absolutely fascinating. I, in the decades I've been doing this program, again and again, a phenomenon has swept through the world of psychiatry or public response to pressure. RSI, for example, comes to mind. All of a sudden, people, in a sense, were permitted to have RSI, and so it exploded. Suddenly everybody had it. You know, I was searching for symptoms in myself. Do you think that to some extent you're describing something along that line, that the society has given permission to have PTSD?
I think there's a bit of that. I think previous generations were quite stoic. As stoic as they were, they still apply, if they were servicemen or women, they still applied for disability if they felt they deserved it. And but certainly the sort of common idea of, oh, if you're in the military, you're traumatized and you get PTSD. And then PTSD gets sort of mythologized. I've heard people say that you can get PTSD just by knowing other people with PTSD, or you can get PTSD just because you think you might be in danger, even if you never are. All of those ideas are absurd. So it gets mythologized and inflated for a number of reasons, I think.
You make the point absolutely emphatically that anthropological research from around the world shows that recovery from war is heavily influenced by the society one returns to. And you quote Sharon Abramitz from the University of Florida, another anthropologist, who says, "We're not a good society." And by society, she's talking about your society, but I'm pretty persuaded much the same applies to Australia, that we are increasingly an anti-human society.
Yeah, what Abramowitz meant was that modern society is deeply alienating of people. We're animals, we're primates specifically. We're a very, very social species. And the wealthier a society, not just America, but any modern society, the wealthier a society, the more individualistic people's lives are. They can make choices for themselves. They can move to California away from their family. They don't necessarily function for the greater good of the community. They're doing jobs and living their own lives. Their welfare is not tied up with that of others. So, of course, we didn't, as a species, we didn't evolve for that kind of life. We evolved to live in some kind of communal setting, with interrelying with one another in groups of 30 or 40 or 50 individuals.
And then you contrast this with life in the military, where you are virtually never alone. Day after day, month after month, you are close enough to speak to, if not touch, a dozen or more people. You eat together, you sleep together, laugh together, suffer together.
Exactly. And that's basically what we evolved for as a species. When I was with American soldiers in eastern Afghanistan in 07, 08, it was a 20-man position on a ridge with a lot of combat. It was very remote. There wasn't any electricity for a while. It was very, very rough. But I could reach out my arm and touch three other men from where I slept at night. That's how humans evolved to live. It's a very, as cramped as it can be, it's a very, very secure way to live. And when people come back from that experience to a modern society, they're suddenly sleeping by themselves in a room. They have their own house. They're leading their own lives. It's terrifying because it's completely individual. And that's what Abramowitz meant by it's an anti-human society. It goes against
She writes quite beautifully, "Our society is alienating, technical, cold, and mystifying. Our fundamental desire as human beings is to be close to others, and our society does not allow for that. And in fact, all the so-called social media is in a curious way intensifying that problem."
I mean, my opinion is that, yes, it is intensifying that problem. Dr. Abramowitz said that to me when I interviewed her a few months ago. And what we were discussing was not just PTSD, but general levels of mental illness in society. So as income goes up, as wealth goes up in a society, the ability to choose individual lives goes up, and also so does the suicide rate, the depression rate, anxiety, insomnia, child abuse. All of these issues go up with income. That's the society that soldiers come back to. Even if they didn't see combat, they come back to that kind of society from the very intense platoon experience that you would even have on a rear base.
Sebastian, this program is technically called LNL, which is short for Late Night Live, but I changed the name to suit the context. Very often I call it Leninel because we're a bit left-wing and bulging. Tonight I'm going to call it Alienel because that seems to fit even better. My guest is Sebastian Junger, and he's written a marvellous essay for Vanity Fair, The Bonds of Battle, just when I sometimes despair of Vanity Fair, particularly since our old mate Christopher Hitchens has passed on. They do a zinger like this, and it's a great treat to have you on the program. Tell us about the White Indian, Sebastian.
Well, that was a very interesting thing. In our history in the United States, there was this phenomenon that really puzzled and embarrassed the settlers and the white society here. It was noted by Benjamin Franklin and other writers and thinkers of the time that young men particularly, but young women as well, who were kidnapped by the Indians along the frontier as teenagers, even as adults, when given the chance to return to white society, almost always refused. They didn't want to leave. And that, worse than that, young men were also continually fleeing white society and basically adopting an Indian lifestyle, moving in with these ostensibly hostile Indian tribes. And it never went the other way around. The American Indians were not fleeing across the frontier to become farmers and plow fields and live a quote, civilized life.
We did some programs on this years ago, Sebastian, and I remember when women hostages, allegedly, were taken back from tribes, white women, they were very reluctant to go and often had to be removed by force.
That's right. There was a treaty at Fort Pitt in western Pennsylvania, and there were dozens, maybe a couple of hundred captives of the Iroquois Nation who had to be repatriated in accordance with the treaty. And some of them had to be tied, and many of them were women, had to be tied on horseback to be brought back to the colonials. So, of course, that flew in the face of white societies and Christian societies' idea of itself as a superior culture. Why would a white person who had been kidnapped by the Indians possibly be reluctant to return back to colonial society? It's impossible. But in fact, that was the case. And so I talk about this because I say maybe veterans returning from war, many of whom, I would say the majority of whom, at least say that they miss that experience and want to go back to it. I compare them to the white Indians. I say maybe they're the modern white Indians who want to go back to a more intimate, cohesive life that they experienced over there.
Now, Sebastian, you've experienced PTSD. Tell us how that happened and what it meant for you.
I mean, anyone who's been traumatized will have a reaction to that, a temporary reaction to that trauma. It's a normal, healthy thing. Car accident, bad divorce, I'm sure. Anything like that is traumatic and affects people. I was in northern Afghanistan about a year before 9/11. I first went to Afghanistan in 1996. I went back in 2000. I was with Massoud's forces of the Northern Alliance. They were battling the Taliban. And a number of very, very upsetting things happened. There was a lot of combat. But one day in particular stood out in my mind. We were on a hilltop position that the Northern Alliance had just taken over from the Taliban. And the Taliban were preparing to counterattack, and they started that with a long rocket barrage. And we were curled up in the fetal position in trenches getting hammered by Katyusha rockets for 45 minutes or an hour, and it was extremely unpleasant. And I got back to the United States, and one day I went down into the underground to take the subway, and it was rush hour, it was crowded, and loud, and a lot of people, and situation I've been in many, many, many times. I live in New York, but this time I completely panicked, and I felt, I really can say, as scared or more scared than I'd ever been in Afghanistan. I thought the train was going to kill me, that the crowd was going to kill me. I didn't know what the threat was, but I felt in deadly danger. And
it sounds like all your nerve ends were extended, that all your perceptions were wildly exaggerated.
That's right. And what I had it in a ski gondola. I just kept having these panic attacks, and they seemed to be situations where I was not in control, where I felt out of control. None of them had to do anything to do with Afghanistan and my experience in Afghanistan, but there are situations where I was not in control and overwhelmed by sensory experience. And it, you know, gradually went away. But I remember, you know, over the next few months, I stopped having them. I recovered. I had no idea. I just thought I was going crazy. I had no idea what PTSD was. I did not connect it to the war at all. And I talked to a lady at a party who was a psychologist, and she asked about my war reporting. She said, have you had any emotional consequences from that? I said, no. But for some reason, I described the panic attacks, and I still didn't connect it to the war. And she said, this is 2003. We just invaded Iraq. And she said, that's something called PTSD, and you'll be hearing quite a lot about it.
Incidentally, when was the term coined? When did it come into common parlance?
At some point after the Vietnam War, I think around 1980. I can't remember exactly, but it was fairly recently.
Yeah, so shell shock in World War One, PTSD. After Vietnam, other foreign correspondents have been on the program report the same phenomenon, that they sort of got through the major crisis, but the wallop came when they were back home. Do you ever fully recover from it?
I mean, PTSD, the last word in that is disorder, and by that I think it means that your life is impaired by your reaction to trauma. So in that sense, yes, my life is not impaired by my reaction to trauma. That doesn't mean that I don't have associations and reactions that are different from other people who haven't been traumatized, but I wouldn't call it a disorder.
Sebastian, you write that roughly 80% of people exposed to terrible events will recover, more or less. And this makes sense if you consider the extreme hardships and violence of our prehistory. It makes sense, you say, that humans are able to sustain enormous psychic damage and continue to function. Otherwise, we would have died out.
Exactly. I mean, we're designed to survive, right? We're primates. We evolved in a very harsh environment. And if we couldn't psychologically recover from trauma, the species wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be here. So roughly 20% of, I mean, I would say almost 100% of people have an immediate reaction to trauma, like I did. But only about 20% develop a long-term problem with it, which would be called PTSD, which is way, way lower than the rates that are being claimed by servicemen today in America.
There are studies that show that different experiences trigger either acute or chronic PTSD. You had acute short-term PTSD, didn't you? That was self-diagnosis or objective diagnosis?
Well, I like to think it was both, but yes, I didn't go to talk to anyone about it, but I trusted the woman that I talked to at this party that the symptoms were classic PTSD, and I sort of watched it go away. But like I said, I didn't lose all of the effects. I kept re-traumatizing myself covering war. And I had some pretty significant consequences from it after I was with some American platoons in 07, 08. You know, that went on for quite a while and actually really affected my life quite a bit.
Last night, Sebastian, I was talking to a documentary filmmaker and the woman whose life she was documenting, an Australian woman who was pack-raped in Africa and who has spent years trying to seek justice for herself and justice for the perpetrators in a fairly ghastly sort of legal system. And it's interesting because you say that in the Journal of Traumatic Stress, published in 1992, 94% of rape survivors exhibit signs of extreme trauma immediately afterwards, but it is argued that 9 months later, 47% of rape survivors have recovered enough to resume normal lives.
Yeah, and that's a fairly rapid recovery compared to American soldiers. And you know, keep in mind, most deployments are not as traumatic as being raped. I spoke with a researcher named Rachel Yehuda in the United States, who had studied PTSD and Holocaust survivors, rape victims, and soldiers. And what she said was that the recovery from rape is in some ways simpler than from war, because there is nothing good about the experience, nothing that the person wants to retain. It's just purely horrible. Whereas with war, a lot of what a person's experience in combat is extremely positive. There are very, very tight connections with other people. There's a good deal of, frankly, love within the platoon, of loyalty. All these very positive human values happen in combat way more intensely than in civilian life. And horrible things happen. So how do you separate out those two things and move on? It's extremely hard to.
Will or is the Pentagon starting to dose up its troops beforehand, its pilots, for example, before they go into combat? Are there attempts to treat it in advance?
I don't think you can treat this in advance.
Well, I'm saying, is there a pill, like, you know, an anti-depression pill that is being perhaps tested?
I'm not that I know of. I know they treat soldiers during combat with pills that help them sleep if they're having trouble sleeping because of nightmares, with antidepressants. They do medicate troops in combat to get them through, which, you know, it's hard to know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. These are natural symptoms to a situation.
Sebastian, I raise it because the Americans in particular have a terrible habit of medicalizing almost everything and finding a pill to pop as a consequence.
Yeah, no, I agree. I haven't heard. I've never heard that they were treating people with depression before deployment. I haven't heard that. And I think even during deployment, they only treat people who seek help and who feel really disturbed.
I raise this because you write in some ways, you've already said that it's a universal adaptation to danger. It's evolutionary. It's common to mammals. Why then see it as a disorder? From the evolutionary perspective, as you say, it's exactly the response you want to have when your life is in danger.
Yes, and presumably your life is only in danger temporarily. I think it becomes a disorder when it becomes ingrained as in a person as a behavior pattern that doesn't stop. So, you know, 2 years later, you're still jumping at loud noises and extremely emotional, having nightmares. I mean, that obviously is getting in the way of someone's ability to lead their life, and at that point, it really becomes a disorder.
Sebastian, I've always believed that nature's answer, or one of nature's attempts to deal with the dreads and the pains of mortality, is a sense of humour. You know, we can, in fact, to some extent, protect ourselves from the inevitability of death as a philosophical proposition, or anything else we fear or dread, through the effects of humour. And history does show that there is a gallows humour, a dark humour, a defensive humour. Look at Jewish humour, for heaven's sake, and for thousands of years, helping beleaguered communities to cope. Did you observe that humour was important amongst soldiers?
Well, I love that theory, and yes, absolutely. I mean, Restrepo, which is the little outpost I was at, that saw an enormous amount of combat, was really one of the funniest experiences I've ever had. I mean, young men in groups can be incredibly funny, and not just in combat, work crews, roofing crews, whatever. I've been around a lot of working men, and when you get them together in a group and give them a miserable job, the more miserable the job, the funnier they get, and that's certainly true of combat.
But as you point out, it's soldiers who aren't in direct fire, who aren't combat soldiers, who report suffering PTSD at even higher levels. Let's examine that paradox, please, Sebastian.
Well, what it seems to be is that the more well-trained a soldier is, the more in control they feel, even of a very intense combat situation, and so the more they're buffered from PTSD. The people who are quite vulnerable are people who are in moderate amounts of danger but are not very well trained, not very well prepared, because they don't need to be, because they're not frontline combat troops. And that seems to be a very complicated situation. And I've learned since writing the article that that was true even back in World War I. And so there's, but there's also this other thing, which I believe is has a very serious consequence, which is even when soldiers are not exposed to danger, they are exposed to the tremendous intimacy and interreliance of living and working in a platoon, and that when they come back to modern society, they go through a kind of withdrawal where they feel extremely alienated and ill at ease. The only language they have to describe their depression during this transition, the only language they have is the word PTSD, when in fact it actually probably technically isn't that. It's some kind of transition difficulty that I think probably should get its own diagnosis.
Sebastian, one of the extraordinary things in your piece is the interesting fact that unmanned drone pilots, for example, who watch their missiles kill human beings by remote control and remote camera, are calculated to have the same rates as pilots who fly actual combat missions.
Yes, and you know, keep in mind those rates would be lower than frontline combat troops. But still, one of the things that seems to be very, very psychologically destabilizing is watching harm come to others. And that's even true of watching harm come to the enemy soldiers. So in the during the first Gulf War, soldiers reported that seeing enemy soldiers killed was more upsetting, more traumatizing to them than even getting wounded themselves was. And then you see that again in drone pilots. They're watching on a video display rockets, missiles that they're firing, obliterating a group of people or a person, and they're not in danger, right? They're just watching other people die at their hands, and that's extremely disturbing.
I remember too, Sebastian, and I'm sure you know this, that during the First World War, many soldiers found the prospect of killing the enemy so repugnant that they deliberately missed, that there was an incredibly high rate of what is now apparently quite deliberate non-targeting. And that figure has been reduced over the war, over the years and over wars by ever better training of troops.
Well, I think what, I mean, I'm just guessing, but I think what happens when you have mass warfare and you're just one person out of thousands on a trench line, my guess is that you feel that you can shoot over their heads, not personally kill anyone, and it's not going to have any impact on the battle. I mean, either the enemy is going to sweep through your trench line and kill everyone or not, and you won't be, what you do won't have any effect. I could absolutely tell you that out at Restrepo, whether it was a 20-man position, that would get very, very heavily attacked, and there was a real chance of being overrun, and every man counted, and every bullet counted. In that situation, they were definitely shooting to kill. They took great delight in killing because every time they killed someone, it meant that they were more likely to survive. So that certainly was not true at Restrepo. And I don't think it was the training. I think it really was the individualistic nature of the combat. These are very small units. These aren't thousands of men lined up in a trench.
There was a very strange noise in the background. I hope they're not coming to get you. Now, Sebastian, suicide. There's a figure of 22 vets a day committing suicide. Is that right?
Apparently, it's around 22 vets a day. What's not commonly known, it's a very misleading figure, what's not commonly known is that 75% of those 22 are over the age of 50. Most of them are Vietnam vets. And that there's no statistical correlation between combat and the likelihood of committing suicide. They're completely unconnected. That does not go with the sort of narrative that's been developed about veteran suicide.
I find that confronting and surprising. I'd accepted that narrative. I think most people had.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people project their understanding of war and what they believe is that combat is traumatizing, which it is, and that trauma leads people to want to take their own life. They're actually not connected. There's no relationship between the two.
Are there lawyers in America, effectively ambulance chasers, who are seeking to persuade vets to claim PTSD as they would do in almost any other field of with an attempt to drum up business?
You know, soldiers don't, vets don't turn to lawyers to get their benefits for the most part. It's more of a procedural situation. They fill out the forms and they file them. I was talking about this with a vet recently, and he was saying, we were saying, in some ways, why wouldn't you want to have PTSD right now? It's emblematic of having served your nation. So there's no dishonor. There's no shame involved. It actually means, it's come to mean you've served your nation. Girls feel sorry for you. And you get to file for disability and get up to 100% disability rating, which is a pretty large check every month. And so there's a lot of, oddly, a sort of incentive to think you have it, or at least claim that you have it.
Over the years, we've also done a number of programs on the fact that the tiny percentage of Americans who actually are put in harm's way, or even back up for those who are in harm's way, is in contrast to the mass of the nation who enjoy war voyeuristically and then become bored by it. And this has led to an argument, and I see that you make it too, that it might be good to mandate national service again so that everyone has to do their share.
Well, the famous figure, 1% serve, I've pointed out that we probably don't want and certainly can't afford an army where 10% serve. That's not actually really solving the problem. The problem is the relationship between that 1% and the other 99. I think it's immoral, I don't think it's ethical to force people to fight, to put a gun in their hands and to fight if they don't want to. I'm not for that. But I think national service, general national service with a military option would be very, very good for a nation. I think it's one of the reasons that Israel has a low rate of PTSD. It really does bind everyone into this idea.
You're not going to win that argument in the U.S. these days, Sebastian.
Well, people are actually talking about it. I mean, the idea of national service has come up. It's come up with General Stanley McChrystal, who is suggesting voluntary national service, which actually I'm not sure that would quite work. But
isn't that an oxymoron?
Yes, you put your finger on it. But the idea is sort of bubbling up. I mean, obviously, it's a politically charged thing. But I think it would be very good for this nation.
Sebastian, it was a privilege to talk to you. Sebastian Junger, writer, documentary maker, war correspondent extraordinaire. And yes, we will put a link on our website to his Vanity Fair article about this discussion. Alien L on RN, coming up, The Philosophy of Giving. Seems only yesterday we were all jumping up and down and yelling about the 1% in the United States of America who allegedly own just about 99% of everything. But I've just discovered a shattering truth, and that is that almost all of us, including you, dear listener, are in another 1% of the world's wealthiest. This will be explained to us by my fascinating guests. We have with us Toby Ord and his partner Bernadette Young. We also apparently have their baby, although at the moment the child is being sort of held at a distance so it doesn't destroy the microphone. And we're here because we want to discuss with Toby and Bernadette an extraordinary campaign they run called Giving What We Can. Toby's an Oxford philosopher, a friend of Peter Singer's, incidentally. And since he was a student, he's given away at least 10% of his income to charity, echoing the Christian principle of tithing. But he's also adamant that some charities are much better to give to than others. Well, which ones and how do we work that out will come in the conversation that follows. Toby's on the blower as is Bernadette. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Toby, when you decided to give money away while you were still a student, were you smoking funny cigarettes or something?
No. As a philosophy student, I had to think about these issues as part of my studies. So that gave me plenty of time to try to really come to grips with what are my ethical obligations. You know,
but Toby, thinking about things is one thing. Acting upon thoughts is quite another and comparatively rare amongst philosophers.
That's true, sadly, although I was actually quite inspired by Peter Singer, who not only talked the talk but also walked the walk in terms of giving to help people in poor countries.
Okay, so you used to talk politics and ethics and your friends kept saying, well, why don't you give all your money to the starving people in Africa? That's a sort of assault that all of us are subject to on a daily basis. Why don't you have refugees living in your garage, you know, this sort of argument. How did you fix on the amount that you could afford to give up? Because students are impecunious people.
Yes. Well, I was living on a relatively small scholarship at the time, which I think it comes to about £10,000 or about $20,000 over the year. And I was trying to live on that while also occasionally getting to visit my partner, Bernadette, who was in Australia at the time while I was in Oxford. And this made me think about my finances a bit, but I realized that I was having a really quite good lifestyle within that amount of money and that I didn't really need much more over the rest of my life.
Was Bernadette a supporter? Well, Bernadette, were you a supporter from the beginning?
Of the ideas, absolutely. I actually came across Peter Singer's works possibly even earlier than Toby did through medical ethics because I was a medical student. And I'd come across his book One World, which was about talking about the duties we might owe to, you know, fellow humans on the same planet. And when I was a medical student, I'd started a more modest sort of 1% type donation at the time to Oxfam. And talking about these ideas with Toby was a pretty sort of natural extension of thoughts I'd already had myself.
Well, given the scale of your generosity versus the size of your income, people might think you were going to become targets or for Oxfam's help. Now, Toby, you worked out that an academic earning around 70,000 Ks a year will make, what, 2.5 million over the lifetime?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, it's not that hard to work this out for anyone, no matter what career they're in, to see how much you earn over your lifetime. I found for me it was about $3 million Australian, and that I worked out how much I really needed, and then I could donate the amount above that, and that turned out to be about two-thirds of it, or about $2 million over my lifetime.
Bernadette, are the two of you incredibly frugal? Do you wear sackcloth? Are you bare of foot?
We're neither of those things. I think what we've really done is just failed to ramp up our spending as our salaries have increased. We both started doing this as students when we were on, you know, pretty modest incomes. And as Toby said at the time, most of our spare dollars were going towards being able to travel and see one another. So as our incomes went up, we tried to not let our discretionary spending ramp up at the same amount, which is a surprisingly easy thing to do. But we still go out and have a nice coffee. We might be more.
Can I ask you a very personal question, Bernadette? How big is your smart screen television?
I don't have a television. I'm sorry. We do have a pensioned-off computer that we watch DVDs on.
Okay. No. Well, I'm delighted to think you don't look at television. I think it's a passing fad in any case. And I'm sure it won't be around by Christmas. Now, the organisation you've set up is not a charity, Toby.
Oh, it is technically a charity, has charitable status. But the idea isn't that our members donate to our organisation and that we redistributed. The idea is that people make a pledge to give at least 10% of their income to wherever it is that they think can do the most good to help people.
But what I've discovered is you also guide our tottering footsteps towards the sensible, the effective, the more rational charities. And you go around ones which you think are profligate or where the philosophy perhaps is ill-considered or not sufficiently efficacious.
That's right. We have two main aims. One is to get people to give more, and the other is to get them to give more effectively. And so we offer advice on that, recommending charities where they can have the most impact for a given size donation.
And it's not a new idea. We came across it actually in medical studies. Again, the idea of a quality-adjusted life year, how much good we can do in the health system with the budget that we have, was an idea I came across quite early. And it seemed very sensible to apply this to a possibly even more important problem of the millions of people living on very little.
I'm an atheist, but I seem to vaguely recall someone called Jesus had a similar argument. Well, that raises the question, are you both Christians?
No, neither of us are religious, but many of our members are from different religions.
And I attended a Catholic school where I think a lot of these ideas were actually part of the ethos of the community.
I like lapsed Catholics. They're my favourite religious grouping because they get rid of the dogma, but they keep the ethics.
We make good drinking buddies,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when I was introducing you two, I mentioned the fact that the figure of 1% has become talismanic in American politics because, you know, 1% of Americans, each of whom have 8,000 scrillion billion each, own more than the rest of them. Americans put together, but you also have a 1% figure, which puts much more humble people into that percentile. And what is that?
That's right. You only need to earn about 80,000 Australian dollars per year in order to be in the richest 1% on a global scale. I think many of us would be really surprised if we look at this information and find out just how wealthy we are compared to most people in the world.
And you make the point that even people who see themselves as rather financially strained can afford to make donations. And one makes the point in parentheses to both of you, Bernadette and I, that when one looks at philanthropy, it's very often the least well-off who make disproportionate donations at times of crisis.
Yes, that's right. And we think that giving is for everyone, not just for those who are very wealthy, even by Western standards. Because we're also wealthy, really, by world standards, there's just so much we can do with our money to really help others.
Okay, let's get on to the quality control now, because I find that very, very compelling. For example, it costs approximately $40,000 to train a guide dog, but less than 100 to completely cure someone in the developing world of blindness due to trachoma. So you would argue, let's give the 100 to trachoma.
That's right. I think, again, this is hardly a very controversial position, that it's we should treat people equally, and people elsewhere are just as valuable as people close to us.
So there's a factor of at least 400 in terms of the benefits you can apply or create by supporting one kind of intervention as opposed to another. That sounds a bit Peter Singer-ish.
It does. And it's very interesting to actually, look at the data on this. I come from a science background and have tried to take a quantitative approach to ethics, really trying to have a hard look at the numbers, work out what we can do to help others. And it turns out that some ways of helping people in poor countries are 1,000 times more effective than others.
This is Late Night Live on RN, and I'm talking to philosopher Toby Ord and his partner Bernadette Young about their campaign Give What You Can, which measures, among other things, the effectiveness of charities. Does your philosophizing, do your ethical views start to influence the charities themselves?
I'm not sure. The charities we recommend are certainly very happy to be recommended by us, and they're already ones that are focusing on doing some of these most effective things. They're often eager to find out if there's ways to stay on our list, and we want them to keep doing these things.
And I think in at least one case, they set up their organisations particularly because they noticed the incredible cheapness of the benefit they could offer. For instance, a schistosomiasis control initiative was launched because it was so ridiculously cheap to treat these terrible worms that cause a huge burden of disease throughout the world. And yet, because there was no commercial motive to fund the drugs, there was no big drive to distribute this trivial treatment.
I hadn't really thought of that, but drugs is just as significant as guide dogs, more so, isn't it, in terms of allocations?
Yeah.
Yes, there are some drugs that cost, we see this, I work in the NHS, And we're constantly, when new drugs are being released, having to make the hard decisions about whether the benefits that can be offered through those drugs are worth taking that money from somewhere else in the health service.
Now, tell me about the wealth calculator on your website.
I thought it'd be really interesting to try to put the latest statistics on world inequality onto our website in a nice, convenient-to-use way. And I was really struck by this when I was a student, and I noticed that even when I was earning £10,000 a year, that I was actually in the richest 10% of the world's population, and that even if I donated 10% of my income, I would still be in the richest 11% of the world's population. And so we encourage people to go to givingwhatwecan.org and try out this calculator and see where they are.
I'm so fascinated by this. Let me see if I can phrase a question here. I understand that it is possible for human beings to live without a very large screen television. I must admit, I haven't tried it yet myself, but I can see that it could work. On the other hand, and I'm not interested, I don't go to restaurants. I've never been interested in the, you know, in gastro porn and the immense amount of money that people spend on meals. You know, I just don't get that. But what's your attitude to food? Do the two of you allow yourselves the odd indulgence, or do you eat as carefully as you invest, in a sense?
I think we both enjoy food, but not in a particularly rarefied way. And for us, it's both a source of social pleasure. You know, we often have meals with friends and family, and something that we do, you know, enjoy making and eating together. But it's all of that can be done without really rarefying the process.
And, of course, one can always go to a library instead of buying a book.
Absolutely, or share books amongst friends.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we found, you know, when I looked at this as to what I'd have to cut back on, that there wasn't really anything that would make a substantial difference to my quality of life. I think that the, you know, when we sit back and really think about this, the real great pleasures and kind of values in life are come from friendship and conversation, or reading great works of literature, or you know, looking at beautiful art in the gallery, or seeing a good film. And actually, one doesn't need to spend very much in order to get a very good life.
Now, there is a child I know within close proximity.
That's right.
Will the child share your views? I mean, this is, you can't know this. Doesn't always
Absolutely.
Follow.
I think no parent could sanely expect their child to reproduce their beliefs.
But I raise this because she will be under great peer pressure from other kids saying, I've got one of these, you don't. You know, this is the way the capitalism works, doesn't it, through the marketing of envy.
That's right. But at the moment, I'm donating about a third of my income. And I'm sure that there will be people at the school that my child attends whose parents earn a third less than I do, and they get by, and you know, we'll get by. I don't see that being too big a problem.
I think neither of us grew up particularly wealthy, we both, you know, for other reasons, went without things that maybe peer pressure would have told us that we needed to have as the absolute latest, coolest thing when we were teenagers, and don't feel hugely scarred by it. So we hope that will be the same for her.
Yeah. Even making the donations that we are, we end up at around about the median income for the UK, which means that half the people are doing it harder than we are. So, you know, we can't really hold ourselves up as self-flagellators or something like that. The point isn't for it to be difficult for us. The point is just that we
realise
that
I would draw the line at flagellation. I think that's the Catholics seem to like it, but atheists don't go for that particularly. Now, okay, Bernadette, you're having one of your charming but frugal dinners, you know, with friends, and you are trying to persuade them to follow your precepts. I can imagine that amongst the many arguments that are deployed is that people would say, well, the super rich don't give much money. They're terrible. They're notoriously lacking in generosity. Why should I?
I don't think there's any aspect of my life where I base my decisions about how I behave on how the worst people behave. You know, it's kind of like saying, well, there's jails full of murderers and thieves, so why should I stop jailing, you know, stop thieving and murdering.
I didn't mean that, but I'm saying you must
yes.
have a lot of dialogues where you are trying to talk people around, however gently.
Yes. I think so, and I think the most persuasive I've usually been able to be is much more so by doing than by talking. I think that people are innately pretty suspicious of grand ideas about helping others when it's not backed up by action. And I think this has definitely been a case where actually doing something has much more persuasive force than talking about it, and which is one of the nice aspects of having the pledge at Giving What We Can, because it lets people act in a way that's publicly visible without being too much shouting in other people's faces about what we're doing.
Toby, I know that you give money to Africa, but you've only been to Tanzania once. That's a roundabout way of saying that pledging money is one thing, but you don't want to be involved at the coalface, do you?
I'm pretty happy to be involved somewhat at the coalface, certainly to see what it's like. But what we've tried to do is to focus our recommendations not on anecdote or from, you know, one particular experience of going somewhere. But there are organizations like the Poverty Action Lab at MIT who do randomized controlled trials, and they look across lots of different interventions in many different countries and try to work out what's the most effective thing so that conscientious people who want to help others can donate to that. So I'm happy to go where the data is on that, really.
You two are a menace to civilized society. You know that, don't you? I'm giving you the oxygen of publicity. Margaret Thatcher think? You are so challenging, so refreshing, so delightful. This program occasionally gives an award. We don't give them out that often. But I'm giving one each to you two. It's called a koala stamp. It has no finesse. It doesn't physically exist. It's a notional koala stamp. But it is, in fact, to be treasured. And you can't eat it and you can't hock it or anything. But we give it to you with the greatest respect, because I think what you're doing is just marvellous. So, Toby Ord, philosopher extraordinaire, and Bernadette.
I hope we don't sound unbearably smug.
You don't sound smug, you sound gorgeous, both of you. Look, thank you for joining us on our little wireless program. We are all suitably chastened, and I shall let you know what results from your appearance. Thanks, Toby. Thanks, Bernadette.
Okay. Thanks so much. That was really nice.
And that, Gladys and Potties, was Bernadette Young and Toby Ord, founders of Giving What We Can, and there's a link on our website so you can see where you sit on the world scale of philanthropic potential. That's your lot for the week. As always, my thanks to the team, EP Garbasario, producers Kate McDonald, Christine Short, Annabelle Quince and Ruth Slee, and sound whiz Joe Wallace. Drive carefully. Talk to you next week. Newstime now on RN.